Maybe we could just go through that again while I have the machine.
I wanted to mention that my father was never... He'd always ask, he said, "Oh, you got a B in that course. What does it take to get an A?" You know? I got an A in the course. Very good, very good. Going to get another one? with a little bit of a twinkle. But it was there. Mm-hmm. It was there. Mm-hmm. And he didn't take kindly to a C in economics. No matter what I explained. Yeah. But pride shown all over him. When I graduated with honors, I think... The fact that I finished university didn't mean too much to him, but the fact that it was with honors, he just puffed up like a... He was a very lean guy, and he never demonstrated much. But that one he was very proud of, and it made me feel pretty good, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So then when the time came to say I was going to check with the draft board again, he said, "Well, if they think you should finish school, then you should finish school." Mm-hmm. He said, "I'd like to see you finish school." And, for the first time, out would come the words, because he was such a patriot before that he would say, "How can you stay out of school when all these other guys have to go to the draft?" Mm-hmm. So I said, "No, that's the way they run it. They told me that." Mm-hmm. So that was what played a large role in continuing with stuff. I don't know why that came out, but I hadn't said much about it.
Yeah.
And it was very important. It was very important. Of course, my mother, she was a mother, the draft. I mean, if the draft never comes around, that's all right with her.
Was your, prior to that time, was your family, did you have family connections in either Russia or Europe?
At that time, my grandfather, as far as I knew, was still alive. My father's father was still alive. Mm-hmm. Those were the only relatives, he and his wife. And it was also just about that time that we lost track of them, because Hitler army overran Ukraine.
Yes.
And they sent all the Jews down to the vicinity of Odessa, just cleared, moved them. They were mostly the Romanian army that was working with the Germans. Mm-hmm. So we lost track of my grandfather. He had come to the United States in 36. He stayed a while, and he wanted to go back. He was too proud to stay there because he couldn't see how hard my father was working. Mm-hmm. And after all, he was an educated man, and it wasn't that way even for him back in Russia, so he actually went back. One of the few who did. Mm-hmm. And... I could never understand it. My dad, I know they argued a lot about it, but we lost track of him at that point. So we knew about where he was until that move in about 40 or so, when they moved not just the Jews, but even the Russians.
Right.
They just moved them right out of the Ukraine.
Okay.
Down into the vicinity of Odessa. And that's the only family that I could ever remember.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was just wondering from what you were saying earlier about your father's, passion about the politics of what was happening back in Russia.
By that time, he was the biggest "I told you so" in the world. Mm. Because there was Stalin's real life came out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And... my parents followed closely through the writings of Kessler, and through the various observers who had been on the scene, and the kangaroo courts, and the execution of the Russian, all the Russian editors, Zinoviev, Kamenev, you remember that? They followed that very carefully. To them, what else is new? Why would anybody want to stay there? My father never could understand when my grandfather went back. Mm-hmm. He never understood it. Mm-hmm. I asked him many times after that, "Couldn't you get him to stay?" Mm-hmm. He said, "No, you couldn't get my grandfather to do anything. You couldn't get your grandfather to do anything that he didn't want to do." Mm-hmm. And that was really the tenor of things, too. Of course, immigration then opened up a little bit, because it was the advent of Hitlerism and that stuff. Not enough for a lot of people, but it did open up some.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so if we go back to Missouri, you wrote the master. You must have done some research for your master's.
Yes, right? Yes.
So I was wondering if you could talk about this. And
yes, it's interesting. Uh-huh. I had to choose a master's subject. After I completed the first year of all these obligations of teaching, teaching assistant. Well, I went on to be a teaching assistant again. And I was so enamored of Dr. Stern, the Irishman from Stanford and then from Illinois, Rodebush. And I talked to him about, I don't want to become a synthetic organic chemist, and that's what these other folks were doing. They were all synthesis people because of Florence, Dr. Nightingale, and others. And I said, I don't want to become a potboiler. And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, is there something that I can do in physical chemistry? He said, well, you can do a lot in physical chemistry. What do you want to do? Well, that just turned the question around completely. Well, by that time, I had just gone through this course in absolute reaction rates, the Iring, Glassstone, Laidler, and Iring. Christophe, you're one of the few people that even knows about that. How come? C'est la vie, huh? Anyway, I said, well, how about if I can think of some reaction that be an organic reaction wants to be, and we can do some rate measurements on it, because I had just taken the basic course in the kinetics. And he said, fine, find one. So I did a little studying, and I came up with an organic molecule, although there had to be a lot to it. We were very concerned with unimolecular reactions, first order reactions. That is, if you have one molecule that doesn't have to combine with anything, molecule A changes to be molecule B. It doesn't have to react with B to become C. It doesn't have to react with anything. What is the absolute reaction rate for such kind of a reaction? I mean, there's, where does it go? And it was a question that I thought about quite a bit. And I said, well, do you even have a reaction? Stern said, well, there are a lot of molecules which change their format. They're unimolecular reactions, first order unimolecular reactions. What drives them? If you measured some of the rates or tried to measure the rates, you could perhaps figure out what drives the thing. And I said, well, can I ask you about it? So the challenge was to find a unimolecular reaction, and I found one which was just a rearrangement. There's a class of chemicals called pinacoles, which are dihydroxy compounds, and in under most solvent conditions, they'll rearrange themselves, they'll turn around, and they'll become another new molecule, but the dihydroxy will disappear. It becomes a ketone. Instead of being a dialkohol, it becomes a ketone.
Okay, I see.
So, and the pinnacle is the name of the class of compound. And it occurred to me that, hey, you know, if you could measure the disappearance of the pinnacle, of the dihydroxy compound, or you could measure the arrival of the ketone, or both, then you could get an idea of how come it happens. And I showed that to Stern. He said, hey, he said, can you make something like that? He said, I don't know organic chemistry, but that looks like an awfully unwieldy molecule. I said, no, that's available. You can buy it. That appealed to him. He said, well, all right, take it on. So that was the master's thesis.
I see.
It was the first step. I just did a few simple experiments of that. I really, in the master's degree, the thesis is the evolving the equipment to measure the rate of that reaction.
What sort of equipment would you use?
Very simple. I had to decide on being able to stop the reaction at certain periods of time, take a sample, don't let the sample react so it isn't going on,
okay.
And now make the measurement of the result, of the end product. And there happens to be, in the parallel hydroxy compounds, there happens to be a specific chemical reaction which reacts in organic chemistry only with parallel hydroxy compounds.
Okay.
Like ethylene diglycol, for example. It'll only react with that. When you get the two hydroxy groups next to each other, the oxidation compound that you use to measure them will identify them. It won't identify the product, but it'll just identify the disappearance of the dihydroxy. So the thesis was, in the beginning, was just measure the rate of disappearance of the dihydroxy compounds. Well, the whole master, for which I got the master's thesis, which wasn't very much, was really to figure out how to do the measurement. And it turned out to be a very simple one. I just had to use the simplest equipments. There were no electrical equipments, but there were means for injecting, taking out a sample, injecting it into a stop bath, stopping that without destroying the nature of the compound, and then analyzing that by organic chemical means, the old smeller. The old techniques for looking for compounds like that, and then doing that periodically at different times.
Interesting.
Under different temperature conditions. So I had to rig a pretty effective constant temperature bath, but it could all be done in simple flasks, simple hardware, nothing fancy, and a direct measurement. And that's what Stern insisted on. He said, don't come to me with these experiments that are third order away from what the product is you're looking for, that you measure two other ones and by difference you get the third one. He said, that's not going to work. It's too complex for this kind of a thing. He was never convinced that I could isolate the structural compound. So I did spend the whole master's thesis proving to him the number of experiments that I could actually measure, put in and find measured quantities, calibrate. And then I calibrated at the temperature range that I was going to make the measurement. So really, the rate of the reaction was never measured at the master's level. I did that 2 years later, or 3 years later when I came back. And it came out, it was a wonderful experiment, a wonderful thesis, because here's a big molecule, you don't do anything except put it in a certain solvent, and it changes over into another molecule. But where does it get all the wherewithal to do that? You have to measure the heat of activation as well as the free energy of activation. And that's the rate. And it turns out that, how shall I put it? It makes the rearrangement at the expense of the entropy, at the expense of the configuration of the molecule.
I see.
The molecule, when tickled by the solvent or by any injecting catalyst, when tickled, prefers to be in its final configuration. It does not like to be where it is, even though that's a natural state for it. So there's a lower free energy, there's a big delta free energy change to a lower stable state. So there's a free energy of activation. And according to Eyring theory, that is a measurable quantity if the reaction isn't too complicated. And then looking at it a little bit more detail, it's still what kicks it. It changes not on the basis of the bonds that are broken or the bonds that are made, because they're the same. Plus they add up to the same type.
Yeah.
But it changes as a consequence of the more stable configuration, which is an entropy factor. Merely the configuration. The delta S change. The rate constant that you measure is at the expense of the entropy, and not the heat, and the two together, of course, form the free energy. But the entropy change, the configuration, and the solvent molecule is the key determinant factor. And you can change that rate by different solvents.
Right, I see.
But always the same molecule. And I was very impressed with the kinetics of the activated complex. And I went back to Lewis and Randall and all the thermodynamics that I ever And I took more courses in it, and I took statistical mechanics because I wanted to get back at that. And that all, it fit together so beautifully. Mm-hmm. And I told the statistical mechanics professor about the reaction. He said, oh, you'll never be able to measure that. It's too complex. He said, well, you've got one molecule surrounded by millions of others. Mm-hmm. So how do you know what is affecting this thing singularly? And so I had to go on, and one of the requirements was to, he was on my examining committee, so I had to do the presentation for him too, because he wasn't convinced him. Stern was very happy for two reasons. One, he didn't have any graduate students working in absolute reaction rates, and because I turned in a higher or prelim in organic chemistry than any of the organic chemistry students.
Wow.
And I was his student, so I beat the organicers at their own game. Of course, to me, organic chemistry was a rote chemistry. You memorized all those reactions. It wasn't entirely that. The thesis work was always different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he was pleased as punch. I was his only student in the period of the 4 years that I traversed. He was a teaching professor. He didn't really think that he didn't really conduct a laboratory as such. He says, you get the numbers and I'll check your numbers. And then you'll have to explain to me just why you think that the activated complex is some sort of a rearranged molecule by itself. And I realize now that that's exactly what's happening in some of the changes occurring in semiconductor molecules themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they move not at the expense of heat necessarily, but at the expense of a spatial configuration, and that's an entropy change. And so they get an energy of activation, and that's how they can classify certain formation of certain molecules. So it fit later I realized it, it fit to what the theory of absolute reaction rates predicts. However, the theory of absolute reaction rates to organic chemists was kind of a new thing. And you could tell them that why there was a large configuration change. They said, well, here's a molecule, and it's losing one of its pieces. While it's losing its pieces, it's now solvating. It's latching onto all of the solvent molecules that it can. It's charged because it's broken apart. And this is, I'm doing my defense of my thesis. And it's charged, and it's and these things are, and it's all broken apart, and now it can react to what the, it can attach to the solvent molecules. So the rearrangement will be a dragging of a batch of solvent molecules to the end components that once that's formed, then the solvent falls away because it has nothing to hang on to. Does that make sense to you?
It does.
It doesn't doesn't have anything to hang on to. So having absorbed all these solvents is a large decrease in entropy, a large change in spatial configuration, a large decrease in entropy. And then when it lets loose, that change is enormous. It kicks all back. And that's what gives drives the rate constant. Because because the bonds that are made are the same energy as the bonds that were broken. They're still carbon-oxygen bonds. They don't change. So if you inject heat to change this, you'll get that heat back when it forms. So where else is the driving force coming from? It's coming entirely from the fact that it's solvating, and then it loses the solvent. Now, to prove that, this is where Stern really nailed me, he says, well, these two, this dihydric alcohol, this 2OH alcohol, can you think of different solvents that would hydrate differently with that? Well, that was I said, well, I don't know. Let me think about it. So I made a search, and I found three solvents, all of whom had a different electrical behavior. They all solvated. I tested that in separate experiments. They all solvated with they all reacted with this molecule, and in different ways. So I ran the same series of experiments at various temperatures and in various solvents. So I crisscrossed the solvent effect, and the rate of reaction was strongly dependent on the nature of the salve that was used and not on the nature of the molecule that was changing.
Okay.
That didn't change. There was no way of saying that it would. So the first solvent I ran it into was ethylene glycol, which is a very highly hydrated one. And then I ran it in dioxane, which is non-hydrated. And I ran it in the third, particular kind of structured alcohol, where it was a bridge compound, where the oxygen was there, but it was tied up.
Okay.
And everywhere where it couldn't solvate, the rate of reaction was, and thus the free energy of reaction, was lower in each case where it couldn't solvate.
Interesting.
And in that, I could only do three because it took dozens of experiments, ages to do that.
Yeah.
And then to do it over again and to teach that physical chemistry class in the same laboratory.
Yikes.
I tell you, it was fascinating. That was, and in the semiconductor work, the moment we got into some of these diffusions and some of these formations of particular molecules where they had to have a, where there was a energy of activation just to do the diffusion. I mean, where is that energy coming from? The molecule isn't breaking up. It's a boron atom when it starts. It's a boron atom where it ends. So where's all this? Do you guys, you electrical engineers, are talking about energy of activation. I said, what are you activating? It's already activated. You don't have an energy of activation. No. If you plug it into the Boltzmann equation or the Arrhenius equation, you get energy. E out is an activation energy, and that's what it is. I said, but what's activating? There was no physical model for it. But the activation is a penetration by the doping atom breaking between silicon atoms in order to fill the vacancies.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's where it's coming from. Now, they don't, you know, it isn't necessary for an electrical engineer to think of that. But it bugged me when he was talking about energy of activation. And with particularly when they would give the paper and they would assign to it, let me get a little more esoteric, they would assign to it a negative value for the energy of activation.
Okay.
Well, that's not possible. If you're going to energize something, you put in the energy. How can it be negative? Negative means it's at a lower state than the starting material when you start. So how can you call it negative? Well, that's just a matter of sign. We'll just change it to positive. I say, Well, the Boltzmann factor, you know, you start rattling all that stuff, and I said, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. You want to call it an energy of activation? Call it that and give it a positive sign. And look elsewhere in your equation for why that can't be positive. Oh, we used to go around and around, especially with guys like Andy Grove. You don't argue with Andy Grove. in a nice way. But it really wasn't, it was a trivial argument because the diffusion occurs. You get the what you want, you get the product you want. And how it got there, you can call a rate constant anything you want, slow, fast, in between, but just don't try to classify what you're doing by their energies of activation. It's funny, I haven't thought about that one since those arguments I have. But you see, at the master's level, I just had to, all I did there really was to find the molecule, and then show that there was a change.
Okay.
That one A went to B, and B was distinguishable from A by separate chemical means.
Okay. So then you continued the research
when I came back 2 years later from the service.
Okay.
I really started over again.
Because
I had already. I wrote it up as a master's thesis, and I got the MS for it, or the MA for it. But I got so close to thinking about molecular changes in detail, and not just a synthesis of a compound or a new inorganic material, that when semiconductor came along and I began to think in that direction, all of a sudden that all began to click together. When I went to work at Shell Development and catalysis, and I began to think of, well, hey, what is this? This molecule, this catalyst is called a semiconductor. And I didn't know what a semiconductor was. To me, it was something that conducted electricity almost. Very simple. So you look it up, that's what a semiconductor is. But I couldn't relate that to the molecule.
Interesting.
But the seed was born. Well, it helped also in the graduate degree that when Shell Development came along, I got two fellowships from them. So for graduate study, I was a Shell Development fellow.
When you returned after the service.
When I returned after the service, I started doing work.
Yeah. Well, can we talk a little bit about your military service in the Navy?
Sure.
So that was from 44 to 46?
44 to 46. That was the tail end of the European war, but the Japanese war was still going on. Well, the draft board got me. But I told them that I wanted to join the Navy, so I was drafted into the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know why particularly. I thought maybe they'd be closer to some sort of scientific aspects than just being a doggy out in the field.
Right.
So I went to naval training at Great Lakes, Illinois, the Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and I served my brutal initiation. The boot training.
Oh yeah.
I think it was, as I recall, it was about 12 weeks, something like that. And you had to hustle. Turned out to be that there were quite a few master's guys in that squadron. All from different parts of the country, but all about with the same kind of story that I had. You know, they allowed them to go to school and finish. The master were physicists, some chemists. So so I felt at home. right after that boot camp training, I had applied. I specified in the draft board that I'd like to get into the Navy and I'd like to go to officers training school if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And they marked that on the draft board. Okay. They marked that in the draft papers. But I didn't hear about that until after boot camp, until I got in, and also got into what they called radar tech training.
Okay.
I wanted to go into that because it was something technical, and it was very useful, turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to radar tech training school, and the two of them, the second one was in Arkansas, and it was there that I got the word that my commission.
Okay.
Commission had come through. And there's an interesting story on the side to that, I have to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I was interviewed for the commission out of the radio tech school on my way to midshipman school in New York, officer training. And the guy who interviewed me was a naval officer, was a commander at the time, and he wanted to know, why do you want to get into the Navy and all that sort of stuff? And I said, I'd like to get, if I could get into the technical stuff, I'd like that, but of course, wherever the Navy wanted to put me. And he said, well, let me look at your background here. He said, oh, yes. He said, what was the name of the ship that your parents came from in Europe?
Yes.
Right out of left field. Uh-huh. Name of that ship? You mean, the ship. They came to New York, I understand.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, it was the SS Orca. He says, that's right.
What?
They had conducted, I was a Russian background.
Oh.
And they conducted extra special checks on the Russians.
Huh. Wow.
They maybe did, maybe on somebody else too. I don't know. They could have. They could have. He was checking to see if the background
story,
check fit together with what I knew about it. Now, if I hadn't known, I hadn't known.
Right.
And, he said, yeah, that's right. I said, well, how did you know? He said, you're asking the Navy how we know everything. We had a laugh over that. And he had the data.
Interesting.
Yeah, they had gone back. And it was a little bit of a problem because what I later did is I wanted very much to go to the Russian language school in Monterey.
Uh-huh.
The one that we just finished, just a month or so ago. Mm-hmm. Beautiful language. I think it's one of the best in the world. Maybe there's some better ones in Russia itself or in France or England. I wanted to go to Russian language school because I still retained enough of the Russian that I could, it wouldn't take me long to learn it. Mm-hmm. Besides, I didn't tell you, but I had to qualify in Russian in two languages at the University of Illinois.
Oh, I see.
And I chose Russian as one of the qualification languages.
Oh, I see, okay.
And German. Mm-hmm. And I had to carry out the qualification tests in graduate school.
Okay.
So I passed the language qual tests. Okay. French was a third that you could take, but nobody used French. Not in chemistry. Well, in organic chemistry, yes. Okay. Yeah, there was a lot of French history in organic chemistry. Anyway, so I applied for that, and I went to midshipman school, and I noted I wanted to apply for that training. And I thought, well, gee whiz, maybe I could get a head start or something, you know, get into a real special place. Well, it took a long time for... I went to midshipman school in New York. Mm-hmm. That was about... I was a 120-day wonder. You got out and you got your commission, you got your ensign bars in 120 days starting with midshipman. And from there, I was shipped to Florida to destroyer escort training school. Uh-huh. It turned out that was just the time when of Iwo Jima and later Okinawa, but even slightly before Iwo Jima, when the suicide planes were hitting us at the rate of one ship a day and losing officers like mad. So I said I wanted to go to language school, and it turned a deaf ear. You're going to destroy escort school, and you're going right out, which is what I did, so I got in the tail end of it.
Okay.
But when I got to my ship, it was interesting, the skipper took me aside. He said, where the hell have you been? You've been 27 days en route. What took you so long? Where are you going out here? And I said, well, no, I started out in San Francisco, and that's where I was told to report, and got aboard a freighter, and the freighter took me to Hawaii, and I took another one from Hawaii where the Navy put me on, and that got down to Eniwetok and Ulithi and those islands.
Okay.
And then from there, there was another one that took me to to Iwo Jima.
Uh-huh. Oh my gosh.
Just at the time, before the time the landings took place, and then we were hit with the landings. And then finally, after more time, eventually landed up at Osaka.
Okay.
At the time of the surrender.
Uh-huh. And, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Okay. And when I got on board ship, he said, where the hell have you been? He said, besides, he said, you didn't get into language school, and you didn't get my permission to apply. I said, I didn't know who my skipper was going to be. He said, you have no right to do that. If you were going to go to language school, you send me a letter asking for my permission as commanding officer to go to language school. Apply that. I just wrote to the language school myself, to Monterey. I just wrote to Commander Hindmarsh, and I said, please, I want to join that Russian. I want to line up. It was not possible because the Russian background was a little rough.
Okay. Okay.
It was already oriented toward communist infiltration in the Navy, in the military. Yeah, they didn't want to take any chances. They did take me if I wanted to learn Japanese. I could have gone in right away. But to do that, I would have to sign up for 6 more years. And that was, and besides Japanese, it would have been useful, but and as I look back now, maybe it would have been interesting to have. But it didn't work. So the naval service was Iwo Jima, Okinawa. Oh, I mentioned got into Iwo Jima, but then we hit Okinawa. And it was, I remember it. I can speak as a veteran.
Now, was that... Were you acting? Were you serving on a destroyer escort when you got to Iwo Jima, or
yes.
Were you being okay?
I was serving on it.
Okay,
yeah, right. But my billet was supposed to. I was supposed to get there 20 days before it came to Iwo Jima, at Aishima at the first landing. Aishima was the island where the big bombers took off.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And. where they delivered the atom bomb from. So, mm-hmm. And he was hopping mad because, you know, the ship was, we were losing ships, and he hasn't got his full complement of officers. Where the hell is this guy? Mm-hmm. He started out 27 days ago from San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah, so I got in on the Iwo Jima Okinawa end. Mm-hmm. That was not very happy. Mm-hmm. Our ship was hit by a bomber. Not, it turned out it was not a suicide plane, but knock on wood, we're here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was a useful experience. I don't know for what, for staying out of another war more than I. And then I finished. I was the last officer aboard this ship. I was the last one to come on as new.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then I would had to stay the longest. So I stayed 2 years and a couple of months before they let me go, because I was the last one in command of the squadron before they left. We all went back to Hawaii, to Pearl Harbor, and from there to San Diego. And there I was discharged.
Okay.
And went back to Missouri. Mm-hmm. Not directly. I went back to Chicago and lay on the beach outside of Chicago until my dad came along and said, I don't know how long you're planning to stay here, but you're not going to stay here. You're either going to go to work or you're going to go to school, but you're not going to stay here. Very understanding. So I went back to Missouri. I was ready.
Okay.
Yeah. It was fun.
Okay.
So then you were saying that your PhD work was financed by Shell?
One and a half, about 2 years, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I would say so.
Okay.
There were two fellowships, yeah.
Okay.
I did not, for the first fellowship was a small one. Mm-hmm. So for that one, I actually also taught.
Okay.
I took a half-time teaching assistantship.
Okay.
But only with Dr. Stern. I didn't want to teach any of the organic chemistry classes. Okay. Just physical chemistry.
Okay. So did you benefit from the GI Bill?
Yes,
okay.
I did.
Okay.
I did. I didn't have to take any meal jobs.
Okay.
I did benefit from the GI Bill.
Okay.
It was a blessing for me.
Okay.
There was no way that I could have done it otherwise.
Okay.
It would have taken a lot longer. I suppose I could have done some teaching in between or whatever. But it gave me a good shot at the teaching of physical chemistry to engineers and to chemical engineers and to medical pre-med students.
Oh my gosh, that's hard work, right?
Christian, Christophe, I wouldn't wish that on you. To teach a chemical engineer something about physical chemistry when he can't even spell it. I guess I'm getting through these questions.
Oh yeah.
So let's see.
So when you came back to Missouri, that was from 46 to 48.
Right.
Correct. Okay.
Right.
And got right back into the
into
the work.
I had to, of course, I had to take prelim examinations for the PhD. And they're different than right out here. You took the whole course of prelims, and then in every field that they taught, and then a year later, no more than a year later, you got a special examination on the thesis work. You had to defend your thesis as a separate exercise.
Interesting.
And the examination was tougher than the defense of the thesis. Examination of the week. I had to write almost every known organic reaction by name. I couldn't believe it. Sheer, brutal memory work. But that's what organic chemists did. The first question they asked me, can you write down the reaction for the pinnacle rearrangement? I said, oh yeah, that's easy. That's my thesis. I said, well, write it down. And then it got tougher from there.
So as that research was towards the dissertation sort of coming together, and you're writing it up, what were your thoughts about your next step? Who were you talking to?
Oh, that's a good question. I had to talk to Shell Development That mm-hmm. was a given because they, you know, were generous. And mm-hmm. So, and I knew that they had a wide variety of effort going on, but I also talked to other schools. Mm-hmm. I talked to Purdue, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. for teaching. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Standard Oil in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and to an exploration company in Oklahoma. They mm-hmm. wanted physical chemists. At that time, I was already classified now as a physical chemist, coming out in physical chemistry.
Okay.
Although at Shell, we kept saying physical organic chemistry. So I interviewed at quite a few places. And Shell came back. William Vaughn was the fellow's name, Bill Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-N, who was examining the fellowships. And he was the chairman of the physical, he was the chairman of the physics department at Shell Development. Mm-hmm. The physics department was concerned with catalysis of organic chemical reactions. That was Shell's business. Mm-hmm. Shell Development did the all the research and all the exploration for getting chemicals from petroleum. Chemicals, not mm-hmm. oil or gas, mm-hmm. necessarily, but chemicals. Mm-hmm. He was a very persuasive guy. I went out there to talk to him and talk to a few mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. around there. Mm-hmm. And I accepted them.
Okay.
I accepted going to Shell Development. It was not the top offer, but it was as good as anybody else around, uh-huh. a little bit less. Uh-huh. But they had a much broader field of effort going on. They had this physics department that was run by Bill Vaughn. They had uh-huh. the organic synthesis department, and they had an analytical department, and even an inorganic one, and they also had a process development department.
Okay.
And it occurred to me that Bill Vaughn seconded it. I said, well, could I do something to do with the rate of reactions? Mm-hmm. Because we can learn some mechanisms mm-hmm. from this, I think. Mm-hmm. Apropos of the kind of thing I did, he said, sure, we've got stuff like that going on. So I thought I was going to be going into his department,
mm-hmm.
physics, but no, I was actually drafted into the process development department.
Okay. Okay.
And this was the department whose job it was to take known chemical reactions mm-hmm. of making alcohol from mm-hmm. propylene, something like this.
Okay.
Simple.
Okay.
It could be simple, it could be complex.
Okay.
And developing a commercial process to where it would be economical to do this so that you could get the alcohol mm-hmm. at a better rate than you could get it from grain or from any other way. Mm-hmm. But it was a way of using a petroleum product converted to a chemical. That was big at that time. And chemicals from petroleum was really something. I thought maybe DuPont might be a place, but I got talked out of DuPont. They said, oh, you're just going to be, you say you don't like to be a pot boiler. I said, that's all they do in DuPont, boil pots. That could have been the competition, you know, talking.
Okay.
And and of course, Shell Development was here in Emeryville.
Yes, yeah, so that was the next question. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And of course, I when I went out to the to pick up my ship, I left from San Francisco, I had to spend a good part of those missing 27 days in San Francisco.
Okay.
And of course, Bill Vaughn poured it on. How can you go anywhere else? It turned out that shortly after I left Shell, they moved. They gave up the whole organization and moved it to Texas. which I was very glad for. That's a whole other story. So I went there and I joined the process development department. I had a chance to do some reaction rate work. Mm-hmm. Gave a couple of papers within Shell.
Okay.
Along the lines that I had done my thesis work. I mm-hmm. used activation. I used I-ring theory for that, and mm-hmm. it turned out to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
I had a nice job lecturing to a bunch of organic chemists as to what that meant. Mm-hmm. They thought it was a bunch of gobbledygook. What's this guy talking about? Did you develop the reaction or you didn't? Mm-hmm. Our job was to take something from the laboratory stage, so that it could go into big equipment. Scale up was the word.
Yeah.
That could be done at some refinery.
Yes.
and there were a couple of those that did graduate to that level.
So you must have worked with lots of chemical engineers then?
Yes, yes. I worked with chemical engineers in the... I was the only physical chemist in the process development department.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. The Marion Taylor, Dr. Taylor, was the... he was a physical chemist. He was the chairman of the department. So he had to approve... He was the one that dragged me into process development when Bill Vaughan came around with all his new candidates. Because I interviewed various ones. And it turned out that Marion Taylor was the one I would have liked to go on with anyway, because the work was much more rate theory oriented, rate of reaction oriented. They were doing a lot of chemical reactions that were dependent on, well, it took so long to finish, to make a simple ethylene plus water to make alcohol. Just a simple thing like that. They had to build enormous plants. They had the big equipment, all that sort of stuff. And they didn't know anything about the reaction. So why don't you just, you know, on a side, just small scale, build some equipment and study the rate of reaction. Now you'll pick the conditions. Oh, I haven't got time to do that. Stick it right in the equipment that it's going to be sold out of. Scale it up. And that's dangerous. That's downright dangerous. And that led to some work that I did that proved that point. To go into large volume work where you, for flammable material, for example.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
And, yeah, in large volume, and you haven't done anything to show where the limits of these reaction, this reaction is. How are you going to quench it, for example? If you want to, yeah, you quench it by running the hell out of it. So process development suited the... at the same time, I got intrigued with catalysis. Now, a big portion of oil work is this mysterious catalysis. And there is a reaction. Propylene can be converted into propylene glycol or glycerin. Either dihydroxy or trihydroxy can be converted by a catalytic reaction with cuprous oxide as the catalyst. Cuprous oxide is a semiconductor. A compound semiconductor. The resemblance between that semiconductor and anything I worked with for 50 years later is zero. But it is a semiconductor. I didn't pay much attention to that. Well, semiconductor, that's an interesting property. And I was curious about the fact that it changes color during the course of this particular reaction.
You study the catalyst.
The catalyst. It's the catalyst. But and the catalyst is not supposed to participate in the reaction. That's against the catalyst law. But here is this silly cuprous oxide changing from black to red. And there is a state of cuprous copper that's red. Then there is a state, and cupric copper is black. And in between, it can be a sort of a mix. So there's something going on that starts out the semiconductor as a catalyst, and then what does its work, and comes back as a non-semiconductor.
Oh, interesting.
And I was, you know, I didn't pay too much attention to that because I didn't know anything about inorganic chemistry and Brillouin zones and and band gap theory. Nothing. Charles Kittel work or any of this. All of this was foreign to me. I'd never even heard of it. That you would have gotten in pure inorganic chemistry, maybe. Not even in physical. You might have got it in Illinois. You would have gotten it in electrical engineering. You would have learned about band gap compounds. But I was never exposed to that. But this the fact that it was a semiconductor intrigued me because it also lost when it changed to those other forms. You could take that out of the you could put it and do it in a separate little beaker, change its color, and put a couple of probes on it, and it won't conduct when it's black or red. When it's black, but it will conduct when it's red. So it goes from cuprous to cupric, and you can measure the conductivity. And I thought to myself, there's, and all of this reaction, it must, it, you can't run this reaction if you just have the black form. You can't make the propylene glycol. You just won't. It just isn't a catalyst for that.
You needed it in the.
You needed it in the Q press. Q press.
Okay.
It ends up either Q prick or mixed because not all the catalyst changes. Uh-huh. You only need a trace of it. So, I thought, gee whiz, if you could, you know, watch it and stop the reaction when the red goes away, you save yourself a lot of propylene. But that was the extent of my thinking. That's when I was hit with the word semiconductor.
And so would that particular catalyst need to be recharged or replaced?
It would be. After a certain amount, that's a good question, after a certain amount of passes made with this reaction, you had to take it out and hydrogenate it and clean it up from the CuO stage back to Cu2O.
Interesting.
Okay.
There wasn't enough of it to make much water or anything like that. But it just reduced it back to the cuprous state.
I see.
And you could tell when it was back there that if you had a couple of probes stuck in it, and I did that as an experiment, you could quit doing that, quit regenerating it when the probe started registering the semiconductivity.
Oh, I see.
And I thought, hey, if there's some way I could control this, I could control the reaction.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was a pipe dream. Nothing in that. The catalyst is going to do what it wants to do in the presence of the molecule that it's hydrogenating. It's not going to do it by itself. But that was where I first got into the semiconductor. Then, then I had a chance to attend a Gordon Research Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very, very popular, and they're still going on.
Yes, yes.
Very good. They were excellent because you didn't publish anything from the Gordon Research Conference, so therefore it could be wide open. You could talk about things.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I listened to a presentation on catalytic semiconductors.
Oh, I see.
And the presentation had to do with what is the nature of semiconductivity.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And not totally conductive.
Okay.
And it was a question of electrical measurements.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But I got a chance to look a bit into the energy bands that went with semiconductivity, and you could see these bands, parallel bands, and big dips in where the catalyst was effective in the band area where there was a dip.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because in that area it was a different compound. Like the cuprous state might be right there, but the cupric state would be on either side.
Okay.
But you could draw the activity based on the band gap theory, based on band gap analysis. But it was just a further treatment, further stimulus of outside stimulus of thinking of new ways of handling catalysts.
Was the group working on catalysis, I'm sorry if you already mentioned this, was that within the process development group, or was the catalysis group its own?
The reactions we studied always started in the group, process development.
Okay.
If it required a catalyst, and some did, we started the work at that level.
Okay.
Sometimes the acid, sometimes the catalyst was a soluble acid in the organic material.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like the oxidation of dimethyl benzene to make terephthalic acid. The two the nylon intermediate that required an acid, cobalt, soluble cobalt, as an oxidation catalyst, and the cobalt slowly changed, and the reaction died when the cobalt died.
Okay,
but that was more of a stoichiometric change than it was just anything to do with semiconductivity. But we started those, we studied those reactions in small scale. Built the equipment. I built a separate equipment to oxidize this material. I didn't realize how dangerous. We were blowing oxygen through a benzene derivative. That's flammable. We're blowing the oxygen. Well, it's all going to get used up so fast it'll never explode. But the process development was doing it on the small scale, and then it went to the chemical plants division, where they did it, they built the big reactors to do that.
Okay.
Now the chances for blow up are much worse over there than they were.
Um,
But I don't know. It's, well, go ahead. Is that?
Oh yeah.
So we it was scale up. That was the name of the game.
Okay.
Scale up.
Okay.
You did it on small scale. Whatever reactions were being developed were done on small scale, and then we transferred it to the plants area where they did the same one, mm-hmm. but in the enormous scale.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, different equipment meant a different behavior. You could talk to the plants guys all day about energy of activation and they would laugh at you. I mean, mm-hmm. what difference does it make? Does it mean I have to change the pot? That was the major work going on. Many products from propylene. Acrolein, that was a... I don't know if you've ever smelled acrolein. Acrolein is a very...
I don't know.
It's a very... penetrating lacrimator.
Mm-hmm.
It would compare it to some of the poison gases they talk about now. So mm-hmm. whenever some acrolein got turned loose in the plants, the plant would bleed.
Yeah.
And so those were the. But it was a wonderful intermediate to go on to other compounds
mm-hmm.
for Shell Chemical.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it at the time, but Shell Chemical's days were numbered.
Why?
I'm looking back. I'm looking back now, backwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the cost of petroleum, the cost of the petroleum starting material
mm-hmm.
Began rising.
Mm-hmm.
Middle East activity okay. and all that
uh-huh.
sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And we were trying to make a cheaper form of ethyl alcohol and propylene glycol from petroleum that mm-hmm. would be cheaper than any other way you could get it.
Mm-hmm.
And just from the chemicals. Well, now... if the starting oil itself,
yeah,
even as it comes out of the refinery, is already more expensive than what you're going to get out of it. And that was a worry.
Right.
Okay.
But in that period, I've never really quite understood clearly how Shockley found me.
That was one of the questions I had.
That's the question you had. That's yeah. But that is where he found me.
Right.
Now that I have a couple okay. of theories.
What are they?
One of them is Shockley knew about Shell development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a place that he knew about.
It had a very high reputation.
It had a high reputation for mm-hmm. chemists, scientists
yeah.
of all sorts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, and I don't know how deeply this was, Bob Bratton was at Shell development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The younger brother of Walter Bratton.
Right.
I tend to put less on that than any other factor.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, he was acquainted, Shockley was acquainted with most of the department heads at Shell Development, guys that, mm-hmm. you know, like my immediate superior, Marion Taylor or Dave mm-hmm. Yabroff, these mm-hmm. Physical chemists themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And he had known them also from Stanford, kinds of relationships.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So he knew the people.
Okay.
So somewhere I got wind of the fact that somewhere I got a call. I got a call from Shockley saying, I'd like to talk with you. And of course, I knew the name Shockley because he had just won the Nobel Prize.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was just a few months before.
Okay.
Okay.
And I said, I guess I ought to talk to him. Why did he want to talk to me?
Uh-huh.
On the side of Shockley was the other factor.
Uh-huh.
And that is, Shockley could see that he needed to have a cross-section of skills. He had a flock of PhDs, but he had no one who knew anything about organic molecules.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
There were some technicians that could handle solvents.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some ideas about using organic molecules in mm-hmm. some format
mm-hmm.
as masking materials for etching silicon.
Hmm. Wow, okay.
Because it was well known that wax, you can etch silicon or glass or anything like that, etch with hydrofluoric
right.
acid if you have a waxy material.
Yes,
okay. So you could, we did this all the time, pour a little blob of wax on uh-huh. and put your initials in it and then etch your initials into silicon with
mm-hmm.
using wax.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to get a background of physical organic.
Okay.
I think that is the primary reason.
You might also have been interested in somebody who knew a lot about process development, right?
That's part.
Process development and scale up.
Yeah, I think you might have been interested in that that part of your background as well.
I was not interested in that.
Oh, I see.
Okay. I didn't care for the scale up work.
Oh, I see. Oh, I see.
No,
okay.
I didn't.
Okay.
That started. You must have read something about that too. That started something else.
Uh-huh.
From my reaction rate background.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that we were very fortunate
mm-hmm.
in carrying out these small-scale experiments
mm-hmm.
at the rate that they were going because they were small.
Okay.
But when they got large,
uh-huh.
the same medium
mm-hmm.
Was in danger of being within inflammable and detonation limits
okay.
of reaction.
Okay.
And Shell had just had a couple of very bad explosions
mm-hmm.
up at Martinez in the
mm-hmm.
Shell Chemical.
Okay.
And they were the results of the detonation of
mm-hmm.
molecules that
okay.
they were trying to oxidize in large
okay.
scale.
Okay.
And
mm-hmm.
I pointed this out.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a new project going,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote a paper about this, on
mm-hmm.
the limits of flammability of organic molecule, of this particular organic
mm-hmm.
molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another factor involved in that when you started to oxidize these organic materials, they first go through a region, they would be flammable, they could just burn.
Mm-hmm.
But if that burning would continue and
mm-hmm.
you gave it enough length of reaction to take
mm-hmm.
place,
mm-hmm.
it could convert, the speed of the reaction would convert and suddenly change over into a detonation, which was 10 times or 100 times faster than the material itself.
Yikes.
Oh my God.
Okay.
So I said, well, gee whiz, we're at the limits of flammability.
Uh-huh.
How do we know when it can convert
yes,
into a detonation?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I was afraid of that in a big reactor
uh-huh.
because it had all the distance that it could use. So I insisted to my then department head, I said, we have to make some measurements of the detonation
uh-huh.
limits
uh-huh.
of ordinary propylene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we found the detonation range.
Okay.
And that killed their propylene oxidation project
okay.
into going into propylene glycol.
Okay.
And
okay.
And propylene alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a project which I separated. I went off site to do this
mm-hmm.
because we set up, we built, I am a technician, we built a big pipe
uh-huh.
with strain gauges in it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, boron tube gauges in it.
Okay.
And we ignited the gas at one end. And we measured the rate of that ignition
uh-huh.
by how fast the gauges popped. And they would go at reasonable limits for about 10 to 15 feet. And then
mm-hmm.
suddenly an acceleration occurred.
Okay.
And vroom, would blow out the end of the tube.
Wow.
And we were in the hills here above the Calaveras Reservoir. This is a SRI property up there. We went up
okay.
there to do
okay.
those experiments.
Okay.
So I wrote a paper on the limits of detonation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It scared the hell out of the process development guys and
uh-huh.
also the engineer, the process
uh-huh.
engineers.
Uh-huh.
And, later, when Shockley was asking me, what did I do at Shell,
mm-hmm.
I mentioned
mm-hmm.
he saw that paper and he wanted mm-hmm. to know what that was all about.
Hmm.
And I explained them
uh-huh.
to him.
Uh-huh.
And while he explained to me band gap theory,
okay.
which went in one ear and out the other, that I learned as a consequence of being exposed to Bob Noyce
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
to C.T. Saw.
Okay. Okay.
Those guys,
okay.
those guys knew it cold. Shockley was not a very good teacher.
I see.
He was a very good interferer, but he wasn't a good
okay.
teacher.
Okay. Okay.
Interfering.
Auf Deutsch, it would be Störer.
Mm-hmm.
He interfered in what you were doing
okay.
because it wasn't his way.
I see.
Oh my gosh.
You told him what you were doing and you say, that's all right. Whatever it was, it wasn't right. But he was brilliant enough to be close to the truth.
Well, before we return to the beginnings of, your conversation with William Shockley, there are a couple questions I wanted to ask, one of which was your life outside of work you know, in this, I guess you were at Shell Development for 9 years or
eight
so?
Years.
Eight years.
Yeah. I left in the middle of the eighth year.
Okay. Well, just what, where you lived, what your life was
well,
like.
Well, we lived in Berkeley, which was a wonderful place to live, up on Tightwad Hill. I guess you know where that is. That's the hills of Berkeley that overlooks the football stadium.
Our street
ended right at the football stadium, so us tightwads could go watch the game. Tightwad Hill. I read about Berkeley. Beautiful place. I really didn't want to leave. It had a beautiful view of the entire bay and the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mornings there were gorgeous. In the chemistry part of it, I don't know how it got started, but a group of us, led by me, well, I was sort of the initiator, wanted to do something for the local high schools. Local schools to initiate them into chemistry, into taking chemistry. We needed people.
Okay.
And they, you know, to teach them a little bit about science and chemistry, but not to do it the way Mr. Wizard was doing it on television, because he was just pouring things together and saying, see what happens, here's A and B, and here you get C. But so everything was all carefully set up to work without explanation. It had to work, otherwise. Mr. Wizard didn't show it. So, because the show was prepared off stage and then photographed and then shown on TV.
I see. Okay.
I wanted to, our idea was to show the actual laboratory. Let the work be done on the laboratory laboratory desk.
Okay.
So we at Shell, a group of us got together and we arranged a show which I called, I named it Tempest in a Test Tube, because it was named after Faraday's work. I'm sure you must have read that. Michael Faraday's work, which he called Tempest in a Test Tube. And the fact the first four experiments were identically the one that Faraday did. What do they call it? The life of a candle.
Right.
Faraday lit a candle and he explained physics. All the physics of the world and the nature of that candle. So we did that. So I conducted 48. I personally gave 48 lecture demonstrations of chemistry on the lab at the table right in front of the camera. Let happen what wants to happen, and it did. And the second series was financed by the Ford Foundation. And we made a movie of that, and that was shown all over the country on WGBH. And I thought that you got some of your might have gotten some of your material from that the WGBH backgrounder, but they have the copy of the movie and all of that. If it became necessary to see that, we could get a copy from them. And it was 24. Weekly shows, 1 hour each, and each one was a series of experiments in chemistry. Each one a different one. And naturally, there was one involved in the rate of reactions. And those were, those took a lot of preparation, and it taught me a little bit about committee work. And what I learned about committee work is don't trust the committee. Do it yourself. Those guys were terrible.
Who?
Maybe one or two. My committee. We had four guys assigned. I was the star, so-called star. And it was all right with them. There was no, in fact, I was voted to be the one. And they, each one of them was supposed to prepare a show.
Oh, I see.
And get the materials together at Shell Development. It was all Shell Development. Well, that worked for the first four. And they gave up.
You
couldn't find them. But there was another Wednesday night coming on, and I was scheduled to appear. So I had to go and beat on my friends, and the same ones that did it before, to get them involved. They did it, but that wasn't where the rate determining step was. And we covered a pretty good gamut of experiments.
And did that? Now that was with the local public television station.
KQED.
And how did you and your colleagues at Shell you really wanted to be a program for high schoolers?
Yeah, we intended it to be at the high school level.
And is that what happened, or did more...
We got more parents than we got students.
Yeah. Okay.
We got college level, and we got a lot of grammar school kids. We had tremendous live audiences in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it got to be a little heavy because, you know, here's all the stuff is laid out there, the gases and the flames.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the audience isn't within arm's length, you know? but it was fascinating. The fact that we got more out of the materials that didn't work on that spot than we got out of anything else. Hmm. For example, my key piece of equipment was a Terrell burner. I don't know if you see. It's like a Bunsen burner,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
only it has a knob on the bottom that you control.
Right.
That was the hallmark of the show. The show opens, and you see this flame being lit of a burner, and the burner circulates, you know, in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the hallmark.
Okay.
Well, sure enough, about the third show, I think it was the third, came up. I couldn't light the burner. He couldn't light the goddamn burner. And the camera's at me. The director is tearing his hair off. Where's the burner?
Uh-huh. What did you do?
So I said, well, let's go to the experiments that don't require a burner. And we'll come back to this one.
Okay.
And of course, like any good chemist should do, I gave him a line of bullshit about, let's check the methane tank. It was running off of a methane tank.
Okay.
Let's check the tank to see if that's working okay. And they're concerned that I'm going to light off the tank.
Yeah.
So I went on to the other experiments. There were about six per show, five to six. And I came back to the burner, and what I had done in between, I didn't realize it, is that I had pulled off the rubber tubing to the burner and then attached it. But in attaching it, I didn't see that there was a pinhole.
Oh.
And so the gas was going out the pinhole and not into the burner. But it turned out to be explanatory, because then I shut off the burner, I shut off the tank, and I said, see, this is what happens in an actual laboratory. Here's the tube, and I pulled it out. There was a big hole in it. Of course, I made the hole a little bigger so they could see it. Well, we had a lot of stuff like that, and that, I mean, it just happens. But the whole theme was, you did experiments live.
Mm-hmm.
You picked them very carefully, of course, because you wanted them to work.
Mm-hmm.
But the Mother Nature often intervened. Mm-hmm. In a later experiment, I had two tanks of methane, mm-hmm. from two companies that donated it, because mm-hmm. I thought, I'm not going to get caught in this again. If one tank isn't going to work, I'll shut it off and hook the burner mm-hmm. to the other tank.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of it, but one of the tanks was a local gas company, and I got a long letter from the one that says, thank you for the free publicity. You showed that the Shell tank couldn't provide any gas for you, but ours did. Because the label was right on the front. And it didn't congratulate me on the experiment at all. But that was quite a... And I gave a series of lectures in high schools.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, the high school teachers just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
They dragged their classes. They canceled their afternoon uh-huh. hourly class, whatever. Then they dragged them to the studio. Of course, we had to arrange it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was very successful. Mm-hmm. By the fact that it was all it could miss.
Mm-hmm.
It was real.
Uh-huh.
And there were some stupid mistakes as well. One time the experiment consisted of taking a piece of pipe, filling it full of water, screwing a cap on both sides,
mm-hmm.
and then immersing that in a bucket of dry ice,
mm-hmm.
letting it freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And I timed it because at the right time it would split,
mm-hmm.
because the water would burst out
mm-hmm.
the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I left it next to last. We came to the next to last experiment. I could see nothing had happened yet. What's happening in that bucket? So I shoved it off to the next one. I said, well, I didn't say anything about what it was going to be. I said, well, mm-hmm. we finished a little early. Well, you know, it's a good chemist that can finish his experiments ahead of time, as long as they go right.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you and good night. We'll see you next time. And I thought it was off the air, and all of a sudden the pipe burst. And I shouted out, I said, shit, it's already gone. And I forgot to look at the red light, which indicated that the mic was still alive. I didn't hear the end of that for the next 2 months. Wasn't thinking.
What was the reaction?
But that was the extracurricular work. I did a lot of lecturing and teaching.
Yeah, that must have been a lot. I mean, it must have been very time intensive.
Yeah, it was fun, and Shell got a lot of mileage out of it. We did say Shell development.
Okay. And how did your bosses and colleagues react to?
Oh, they liked it. They liked it. Oh yeah, the process development department head. He said, "See, that's what we do in process development all the time."
And are copies of the program?
Yeah, that
available?
Has been that's been. I'd have to. I may have a tape. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I may have a tape. I also have a tape. I wouldn't. Sheila would ask me about it. I have a tape that mm-hmm. that some one of my erstwhile friends. Mm-hmm. He collected all and kept on one tape all. Mm-hmm. He cut out the pieces of the things that didn't work.
Oh.
And he put them into one tape. Oh. So somewhere there's a tape of boo-boos. I'd be willing to let you see that. I don't know if I'd want to reproduce it. But I'll have to check to see if that... Yeah. I know WGBH has a copy of the Tempest in a Test Tube. Uh-huh. Tape, but that's some years back. Maybe they've lost it since then. But I'll make a check from this end. Maybe I can call you when I find out something.
Well, it would be interesting
take a look at it. We tried to resurrect this about 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. That whole series with the local chemistry department. The same with the chemistry department. Uh-huh. The same station. Mm-hmm. But to use Shell is no longer there. But we ran into a lot of difficulty. For one, the experiments I did, I wore safety glasses, mm-hmm. but not all the time. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to take a chance on doing a show, mm-hmm. showing where. Where the lecturer was not wearing safety glasses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I said, well, we could make a point of that, or we could mm-hmm. just take out the ones where so that I had a lab coat on mm-hmm. and lab gloves, but not always safety glasses. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there was a lot of worry about whether that should go. Then a question of financing, who's going to pay for these? And the mm-hmm. local station couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So it fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have done it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
50 years later, and even show it as this is the way you shouldn't do it,
Absolutely.
Show experiments done without safety glasses. Or, mm-hmm. In a few cases, like the one with the iron pipe, I did with safety glasses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the teacher that reviewed it, two of them wanted me, they would have wanted I should wear safety glasses every time, no matter what the experiments were, which is the way it should have been done correctly.
Mm-hmm. So,
that occupied a lot of spare time.
I can imagine. And, let's see. Well, Christoph, where do you think we should go from here?
Are we...
Let's see, about 5:30. Well,
is the pace okay for you?
Oh, very much so.
Because there's a lot of ground, you know.
There's a lot of ground.
But I'm letting you set the pace.
I'm thinking that, maybe let me just switch this off for a moment while we talk about this.